to the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio.
We need to understand as human beings that we are part of this ecosystem.
We are nature.
In the forest.
I teach many people, you know, don't cut the trees.
Through their roots because of the relationship they have with living microorganisms.
They do lots of really important things in our ecosystems.
And there are cycles, natural rhythms, this planet that we're so interconnected with.
We really need help. The Amazon really need help.
I'm Bia Sharma, almost 50 years.
The indigenous need our help. They need our help now.
Medicine.
Wild Botanic Garden. It's actually floodproof, bombproof and radiation proof as well.
There's young people out here that are doing amazing things, and the press needs to fix up and start telling some really beautiful stories.
We can always make a difference.
We be the change.
Plant trees, they help us breathe.
Hi and welcome to the Environment and Conservation Show here on UK Health Radio, your feel-good radio. And for today's show, since it's that kind of time of year when things are slowly drawing to a close and we're becoming more kind of insular and keeping warm and cozy, just decided to cherry pick some interviews from the year. As kind of a thanks to everyone who's participated on the Environment and Conservation Show, which has been running for roughly around a year. So it's just been an amazing time. We've had so many interesting guests on the show talking about such a variety of topics to do with how we can make this world a better place. So I really hope you enjoy. Please feel free to leave any feedback or comments. And to share the show if you really do get something from listening to it. I really hope you do. And thanks for listening and enjoy.
Well, now what?
What do you do? What can I do? Yeah. Or what's the solution? Yeah. Just remember, you know, I just feel like we still, you know, do we have the same wonderful kind of robust ecosystems we had even when our grandfathers were alive? Did they see the same kind of wonderful, robust ecosystems that their grandfathers saw? No. So it's diminishing with every generation. And that is the danger. But the hope is also that we still have this wonderful ecosystem. We still have kelp forests. We still have biodiversity in these kelp forests. We still have the opportunity, the window, the time to protect what we have and to make a difference and to change things. And that's true of any ecosystem that is still existing. The Amazon today may be on fire. A lot of the parts of the Amazon is actually releasing more carbon in the air than it's sequestering. The Amazon in its own way creates microclimates and causes rain in parts of the world, and that's changing the weather in South America. And all of these challenges are happening there. But there's still parts of the Amazon that exist. There's still parts that are incredibly biodiverse. What it takes is political will and people. We need to understand that this biosphere, without it, we're dead. That's number one. But more important than that, look at this world around us, this beauty, this sentience, this life. You know, we have a moral obligation to not mess with it in the way that we're messing with it. You know, regardless of our own survival or regardless of what it does for us or not, its intrinsic value is so extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, it deserves to thrive in its own right. So to me, that's really where we need to find the inspiration, the hope and the balance. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the beauty about it is just watching how quickly nature bounces back when you just leave it.
And what is it about the tribal shamans that they have to say about the forest? What kind of knowledge is it that they're trying to pass on to us and to the future generations?
They say that people are not different from other animals, that we need to live in harmony in forest, don't take more than need. When traditional indigenous hunters go, for example, first they pray and they ask mercy for animals that they need to kill for survival of their tribe. If they need to cut a tree, for example, they also pray and ask mercy of that tree that they need to build a house for. And if they want to fish, for example, they also ask permission. And they never take more than they need. It is not in their custom to sell something what they take from the forest. They take only as little as necessary for their survival. Now many of these tribes go to cities, especially young people, and they lose these traditions, knowledge, and it is really very important to speak to people who knows how to live in harmony with forest and distribute this knowledge widely.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I moved to the farm because I kind of became what we call a mycophile, so someone who's slightly obsessed with mushrooms. And I thought it would be interesting to actually, you know, spend time with the mushroom every day in order to, I don't know, become mushroom or like start thinking like a mushroom or smelling the mushroom. I mean, it's also to do with the senses, of course, you know, this kind of awakening the senses. And so, yeah, part of the day is the actual harvesting of the shiitake, which we do in the morning. And then I also, yeah, spend time writing my book, which is called Mycelium as Methodology, in which I look more into there's a biomimicry of the mycelium. So
what do you mean by biomimicry?
Biomimicry is like the practice of looking at natural things or processes in order to build our society. So like it could be, a lot of biomimicry is object-based. So that would be looking at the bird, looking at the wings of a bird, for instance, to design an airplane. But my approach is more looking at system design. So in this case, like, yeah, the actual network of the fungus and how it organizes itself and how it behaves and exchanges resources and how different species are mutually beneficial based on this kind of transport network of the mycelium. And then how we can, from that, develop a blueprint for just ways of collaboration, but also organizing networks, organizing food distribution, organizing activists, like how activist movements could organize themselves, like uniting battles. Yeah, there's a lot of lessons in the mycelium, I find.
So it's about teaching people to be self-sufficient when their government isn't able to or doesn't want to step in and provide for them on a basic level.
Yeah, we don't like to use the word teaching. I think the most important thing to understand that this is empowerment. A lot of people on this planet have it within them, the knowledge within them, be it from their ancestors somewhere down the line, to understand how to grow food. You know, this is a primal instinct of ours to be able to put a seed in the ground and grow fruit or vegetables or plants. So we're not teaching anybody anything. We're empowering them and giving them a little bit of a nudge and reawakening something that was inside them already. Mm. But I think you're definitely right in regards of the human rights side of things. I don't think that we are, with everywhere that we work in the developed world, we are calling out the government, but we're definitely asking the powers that be internationally to please wake up to the fact that this kind of movement needs to be in schools. Social education Or social education doesn't only need to be in schools, but it needs to be something where people could be signposted to amenities for society. This is very, very important. Some people can't afford to go to school. Some people don't have that liberty. Some people will go throughout their whole life without being able to read and write because of formative years where that's been taken away from them. So this needs to be something that's a social movement. And it is either social education in schools, institutional in regards of being in the institution, but not in an institutional way, and some kind of amenity outside of the school environment as well.
Completely. And we're not just talking about in South Africa, but here as well, right? Because there's 100%. Certainly not enough outdoor education in schools or green spaces.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I think that the practicality of using your hands and hand-to-eye connection, sensory environments, you know, this leads onto all kinds of knowledge basis, primary knowledge basis, but also this leads on to all kinds of avenues for you to understand not only yourself, the environment that you're in, but others around you as well. And this is very, very important. And this is not, and this, you're speaking to somebody that's not an academic that works in the academic field and is highly regarded for the work that I do in the academic field as well. And I'm not an academic in the slightest. So I'm proof in the pudding that you can do something like this from a practical basis and still get high regard or esteem for the work you do by academics internationally as well.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
How good are vitamin C supplements? Usually only a small proportion of vitamin C actually reaches your cells and has a positive effect. Whereas the high absorption levels of Goldman Laboratories' liposomal vitamin C help maintain optimal vitamin C levels in your body and strengthen your immune system. Now get 10% off when you choose Goldman Laboratories' liposomal vitamin C capsules. Just quote 10 off at goldmanlaboratories.com.
Do you suffer from pain? B-Cure Laser, a home-use CE-approved medical device for the effective treatment of pain, is now available in the UK. The results of a double-blind trial has shown that B-Cure Laser offers a significant reduction in pain compared to the placebo group. To get your special B-Cure offer now, call free on 0808 501 5122 or Google Radio Pro London. B-Cure Laser.
The station that makes you feel good.
Is a very important tree in Cyprus. There's actually almost 100 varieties. And in Katodris there's a gentleman, Yakubu, and he has one named after him. They all originate from the bitter almond, the wild almond, but some of them now have been selected and you have this 100 different types. Some of them have a bigger nut. Some of them have two nuts inside the shell. And some of them are used for completely different things. Like the bitter almond, this wild one, is more medicinal. So people who have high blood pressure are meant to take one every day, for example. But if you take more than five, you're likely to fall over because they have a poison in them. If you make the local sweet here, which is a bit like marzipan, you use 10 ordinary almonds and one bitter one to get just the right flavour. Oh. Cyprus used to be the biggest producer in Europe about 50 years ago, but doesn't even feature now on the table because there aren't really enough people to pick the almonds. And Paniata, when we go picking them with a big stick and you rattle it in the crown of the tree and you have a big net out. And she always goes very tearful because when she hears that sound, it makes her think of her childhood. Mm. Because nobody would leave them on the ground like this. This is just a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
We gather them and use the nuts, But we also especially gather the wild ones, the bitter almond, because it grows very quickly. So you plant it about 10 centimetres down. You have to cultivate the soil a little bit. And as long as it gets that autumn rain, you do nothing else. Mm. I have one by the tool shed at my house, which is as tall as this, and it's 12 years old.
Oh, wow.
12 years old. I remember it growing and thinking, shall I leave it or not? So it's a great afforestation tree, because it'll grow in very poor areas, and it'll act like a nurse for other trees to come in a matrix around it. It has a beautiful taproot going really deep, so it gets the last little bit of moisture. And of course, in the spring, they go from white to quite a deep pink, maybe 20 different shades, and it's absolutely spectacular in these mountain villages. So it's a real treasure, and we have to promote it and look after it. This one here has got a lot of sucker's look. You see these straight branches coming off? That's taking the energy from the tree, and they should be nipped off, like you would take suckers off an apple tree. But these are very useful for making walking sticks. It's very hard, very durable wood almond. And there's some crackers here.
And is it a similar story to the olive groves, that the almond trees are now looked after by the forest?
No, but maybe they should be, some of them. Because they grow quickly, these are not so old. These might be 100, not even 100, maybe 70 or 80 years old. But there are some beautiful old ones. And if they're not looked after, they will die, because they have to get the moisture to the root, especially as they get older. Trees are a bit like people. As they get older, they're more susceptible to disease. So if there's a hard summer, even a tree like this can die. In fact, if you look at it, it's looking a bit wilted. You know, the leaves are hanging a bit. They just need a bit more care and attention. And it's such a beautiful tree and giving so many products and cultural products. I'm looking for some resin on this, but I can't see any.
There's some there.
Ah, yeah, here. Yeah, yeah. This used to be used in the church and all sorts of things for burning and...
So what's happening now with the almonds? Are they just importing everything?
Yeah, from California.
Well, that's crazy.
Absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
They make a beautiful sweet here called shujuko. It's a Turkish word. And they put the almonds on a string and they make a mixture of grape juice and corn flour and vanilla essence and sugar, vanilla sugar, and they dip it in maybe 5 times and dry it each time, and it ends up like a sausage. But it looks like an intestine, actually, because it's bulgy like this. Mm. And then you chop it into slices. I think you've had it.
We've had it. They look like dog chews.
Dog chews, yeah.
And we saw it in the winery.
Yeah, yeah.
And Martin, those almonds, are they local?
No, they're from California.
No way.
I remember talking to them at the winery and saying, why aren't you using local ones?
Yeah.
And he said, you gather them and I'll buy them. Now, there is a little silver cloud on the way because of drought in California. They're starting to fail, the almond crops, and maybe we'll just have to. We'll have to look after European almonds better.
I would say, on topic of regeneration, this is where we need to be very careful about how we move forward, because pesticide companies would like nothing more than for a definition of regenerative agriculture to take hold that does not include pesticide reduction. Organic farmers are the original regenerative farmers. All of the same practices that we're talking about in regenerative agriculture, composting, crop rotations, cover cropping, crop diversification, are the basis of why organic farming works. And that organic legal definition prohibits the use of over 900 different pesticides that are otherwise allowed in agriculture. So there's concern that so much of the energy behind soil health is shifting towards regenerative agriculture, which has yet to be defined in any official way. And there are, you know, as we see that play out, I think that this study, as well as the many others that are out there about the harms of pesticides, really need to be a part of that conversation. We need to ensure that our discussions about regenerative agriculture, our definitions of what it means and how we put it into practice, really include the reduction of the use of toxic pesticides, not only for the soil, but for all other organisms in farming ecosystems, for aquatic ecosystems, and of course, for our own health.
The fact that the wild bananas have seeds in them and the cultivated ones generally don't, it's not that it's just genetically modified and that it's been selectively bred to not have these horrible, massive, horrible seeds in them so that they're actually edible. But in terms of, you know, like in terms of growing them in farms, a lot of the farms will take cuttings. So I don't know if anybody's ever grown bananas, but they are prolific in producing these kind of small baby bananas at the bottom. So that's essentially how a lot of the bananas are grown, basically, is through cuttings or little plantlets.
So I assume that you have seeds for the Cavendish banana in Kew.
Well, we have seeds of the wild relatives of cultivated banana. So, and we have seeds of all different types of species of banana. I think there's about 90 species of banana or more out there.
So going back to, I know you just brushed on it very slightly, but the fruit and nut project we were talking about. Can you tell me more about that and what the idea behind that project is?
Yeah, so Fruit and Nut Project is mainly based in Armenia and Georgia. So we're our partners in Armenia and Georgia, and we're working really closely with both of them. I mean, we've been working with the Caucasus partners for over a decade now. And it's not but the unique thing about this project is that it's not only the partners that we've been working with for a decade on, but it also involves kind of like rural communities in the mountains where wild harvesting of kind of fruits and nuts are still very active. So these are kind of like small families and communities that would harvest some produce. So for example, like wild pears or even hawthorn to make into jams. And some of them are very, very much linked to their kind of rural livelihoods, really. So we're working with these communities to pinpoint species that are most precious to them, so most important to them, and also linking that to the National Seed Bank, so the National Seed Bank in Georgia and the National Seed Bank in Armenia, to train them on how to collect these species sustainably, and also working with the gardens out there to show them how to do propagation and to actually safeguard some species and develop training programs to cultivate the plants so that we can alleviate some of the wild harvesting pressures, alleviate kind of over-harvesting, really. So this has allowed us to actually capture kind of the local knowledge of these plants, which is so precious. And, you know, indigenous knowledge and local plant uses are kind of diminishing, and also enable us to identify essentially what is most important for local communities and enable them to conserve, you know, their own biodiversity in their region as well.
Yes, and it seems like, I don't know, for me more recently, it seems that scientists are becoming more aware of kind of indigenous knowledge about plants, and it's becoming more of a kind of reciprocal relationship where they're teaching you perhaps what the local names are for plants and maybe what the harvesting methods are that scientists haven't been aware of. Is this something you experienced in your fruit and nut project or in any other projects that you've worked
on? Yeah, I don't think it's a new thing. I think it has always been that way in terms of knowledge transfer and collaborative working. In majority of the time, anyway, obviously you have, pockets of things that maybe not you know, practices that are maybe not too great, but yeah, it's getting a little bit, it's getting more in the spotlight recently in terms of Indigenous knowledge. And yeah, so it's really interesting for myself personally, because you never stop learning with this job.
Well, the people, they in the old times, Cyprus was really full of forest, really. And they used to call here the Soessa. That in Greek, the forest is the Thassos. The Soessa, that means something that is having a lot of Thassos. And of course, slowly, the people, they needed to cultivate, so they were cutting the trees and preparing the place to make their living. Now from outside, there are some things that they could take, like mushrooms when it was time, or the mosfila, and of course a lot of wood they used to cut. Now, of course, it's forbidden. We don't have a lot of forest anymore. So you have to be very careful with the forest. But at that time, I think people were more careful and they didn't had a lot of fires in the forest. I don't remember anybody saying that on that time it was a big fire and the people, some of the houses were burned. It was not like this, even in Gornos, which is surrounded by forest. In Gornos, you can find people speaking about the forest because the village was in the forest. And until now, they have all around them forest, pine forest. Between Gornos and the Lykippos, and between Gornos and Keras, something like this. I know my great-great-grandfather, he was going for shooting sometimes, but there were a lot of hares and things in the forest at that time. It was not really a forest. They just go around in the village.
For the olive trees, and I prefer some trees, forest trees, that they are also giving nectar for the bees, because not every tree or forest tree give nectar for the bees. Like the pine tree doesn't give nectar for the bees, except some special pine trees in Greece. They give honey, but not blossom honey, not nectar honey. It is Melitoma. It is Melitoma. It is very, very small. It's like insect. Psora, what is the psora? Very small on the trees, taking juice of the trees. We call psora. And there is a special, this insect in Cyprus, living on the pines. And they take juice from the pines, and after give from their bodies some very sweet, like syrup, come outside of their bodies. And the bees collect this syrup. This syrup, after the bees make honey by this syrup, but this honey is not blossom honey, we call Melitoma, not blossom, not nectar honey, but it is honey by the bees. And also the pines, help the bees to collect honey by this way, not by the flowers, not by the nectar. But we have a lot of other trees making flowers, forest trees. And also we have forest trees making fruit, like mosfilo, jar. We make also jar. Mosfilo is very, very small.
And you're an apicultor today? Yeah? You have bees? Can you explain us, at some point you start to be an apicultor?
When I was very young, I was very afraid of the bees. But when I was engaged and married in Skadodris, my wife's father had all hives, little beehives, and I started helping him.
And slowly, slowly, I started loving the job, and I became beekeeper and as a job hobby. And after retiring in 2006, I start more professionally being honey and bees.
And what can you tell about the relationship with the bees and the forest? What is your relationship with the bees?
Bees and the forest?
And you?
There is a triangle. Beekeeper, bees, and the trees, and the forest trees. And give each other something. The bees give to the beekeeper the products, like honey, like pollen, like propolis. The beekeeper give to the bees the working and the caring and a lot of try to keep them. The bees, the forest, give to the bees the nectar. Now the bees hot, they give to the forest, give back to the forest and the plants, the pollination. And the pollination is the most important working for the planet. Without pollination, the seeds and the flowers become very, very not strong. Because the pollination, the bees transfer the male material of the flowers is the pollen, and transfer pollen from one tree to the other tree. And so married, the male material of the first tree to the female material of the second tree, and so married to strange. Without the bees, the flowers, they might marry between themselves. And after two or three generations, the seeds are useless. And so the trees and the forest will be destroyed by themselves. And so the bees make this very, very holy job, calling.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Galar Light is the quantum energy emitted from the universe, from the sun and stars. Now, Tom Palladino, a humanitarian and Scalar Light researcher, has created the world's only Scalar Light healing system, a system that can bring long-distance healing and wellness to humans, pets, and plants via a photograph. Get your free 15-day trial now at scalarlight.com or click on the Scalar Light banner on the UK Health Radio website.
Shields like masks are top of mind right now, but did you know you have inner armor working constantly to protect you from pathogens? It keeps you healthy and thriving. It's your immune system. Ion Gut triggers the body's natural ability to support gut strength all year long, so your immune system can protect you when you need it the most. How are you treating your inner armor? Visit uk.ionbiome.com to learn more. Ion Gut. Protect what protects you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
In the forest, the medicine is related to plants, like in the city. In the city, the medicine is related to plants. We are using plants in our pharmaceutical industry. But the indigenous, when you use the same plant than we use in pill, the indigenous will have a spiritual connection with the plant. It will have an inner talk. And if you have experienced the consumption of plants, the plants modify our brain, modify our conscience. And when we eat them, they communicate with us inside ourselves. The ayahuasca is the most spectacular way to realize it. But there's indeed all the sort of plants. people get addicted to tobacco, and the tobacco is speaking to them when it misses them. There's many plants that are relaxing you and changing your perception of the reality. You cannot sleep, and you drink a chamomile and you feel more relaxed, and suddenly there's less problem. But the reality was the same. So, because everything is imaginary. Oh, this is, I think, maybe the relationship. Everything is imaginary, and everything is the creation of the spirit, as the Dalai Lama said, for instance, but also the psychology, the contemporary psychology, and also the sociology of imaginary, for instance, said that everything that is existing is a concept, the creation of the mind. And when we eat something, this mind is changing. So I believe we have lost holistic approach of medicine. And I'm not talking about superstition, like, I'm going to pray this and I'm going to be healed, or I'm going to ask this to heal my... No. I'm really talking about something that is physical, that when we eat a plant, we lost the conscious of that we are communicating with the plant at that moment. And our medicine have totally lost it.
The Amazon rainforest is home to more than 80,000 plant species. From these, more than 40,000 play a critical role in keeping all of us alive by regulating the global climate. And apart from being known as the lungs of the planet, the Amazon also receives the title of the world's largest medicine cabinet. In Western modern medicine, around 25% of all drugs are derived from rainforest plants. And this is a pretty impressive number, and especially considering that less than 5% of Amazon plant species have been studied for their potential medicinal benefits. So some of the famous kind of modern medicines derived from the Amazonian plants, as well as some huge potential, has been noted but remains for now clinically unproven. So for example, the one that we know here are cat's claw, cinchona, curare, jabrande, Sangre de Grado, and Tayuya. Cat's claw is an Amazonian vine, and it's been used for centuries in traditional jungle medicine. Both of its bark and roots are used by indigenous tribes to treat arthritis, stomach ulcers, inflammation, dysentery, and sorts of fevers. And it also thought to help stimulate the immune system, to help relax and soothe muscles, such as intestines, and, you know, it's got so many benefits. Cinchona is a tree that grows in the Andes, and it's the highest jungles of the Amazon basin. And it's one of the world's historically most famous medicinal plants. And it's well known globally for a source of quinine, a medication used to treat malaria and babesiosis. And it's used from the tree bark, and it's said to have treated malaria since about the 1600s. And it was the first isolated from the bark. And it's for this reason that it is the national tree of Peru. And it appears on the Peruvian coat of arms. So yes, that's quite an amazing one. It's also amazing that from where we can catch malaria, there is also a plant with a cure for it in the same place. Curare is another common name for an extract from various plants found in the Amazon basin. Indigenous hunters in the Amazon have long been using curare as an arrow poison. But in modern medicine, curare is used for general anesthesia and to treat muscular disorders. So it's not to be trifled with, obviously. However, curare poisoning in humans has the same effect as a total locked-in syndrome, causing paralysis or even voluntarily controlled muscle in the body, including the eyes. This is why the Amazon is known as the world's pharmacy cabinet that is right there for us to use, only if we could understand it a bit better and perhaps respect it more as well, we would be able to unlock some of the huge healing potential that is available within the Amazon jungle. There is so much healing plants that come from the Amazon, and one of which that is most commonly known in the West is ayahuasca. In Quechua, which is the indigenous language of Peru, aya means spirit or soul, or it could even mean corpse or dead body.
and huasca means rope or woody vine. So the word ayahuasca has been variously translated as linea del alma, or the line of the soul, the spirit liana.
They'll release these parasitic wasps into the field, so they have these sort of production line producing these parasitic wasps all year round, just so that they can use them as pest controllers in their fields. So I think the parasitic wasps are of the wasps that, well, people generally don't think of them as being the same as our yellow jacket wasps, and they're not at all. They're not stinging wasps, but we have appreciated the value of them for many, many decades. But the social wasps, I think, are the ones that have given the term wasps a bad press, because, you know, even I would admit that they get a bit annoying towards the end of the summer in the UK when they, you know, you're sitting outside having your barbecues and along comes the wasps and, you know, they get...
That's when they are actually desperate for our food, because their colonies are collapsing. So by the end of summer, they're actually coming to us for sugar, because they're completely, I don't know, completely deranged and needing anything to just kind of go to, because their colonies have collapsed.
Thank you everyone who has been tuning in today to the Environment and Conservation Show here on UK Health Radio. Today's show was really just a reflection of our year broadcasting, and together with Yara, I hope that we've brought you lots of knowledge as well as inspiration and guidance about the natural world and ways in which we can interact with nature in a more positive and, I guess, more wholesome way. And this show really aims to give a spotlight to lots of campaigns, scientists, people working on the ground who don't often get a say in kind of mainstream media. So that's kind of our aim with this show. And in order to do this, we always need help sharing and basically just publicizing the show. If something inspires you or interests you, also feel free to get in touch. And if you feel like you have something to say and you have a story, then we want to know. So you could get in touch either with myself or Yara through the UK Health Radio website. And have a wonderful Christmas and a Happy New Year. And I hope to see you again next year for another show. So stay tuned. Thank you.